Good morning. Please be seated. Next matter up is Tullis v. Tullis. Welcome to our first day of arguments back after the COVID. The only main change is when you finish arguing, take a break for a second. Our bailiff will wipe down the podium. You're free to use your mask or not. It's up to you. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Shelby Lemel of Masters Law Group. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal and thank the court for having us today and for the precautions taken to make that work. I do intend to wear this. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Let me know if that changes.
Thank you.
So a couple issues before the court today, and I'm going to focus on the sole decision-making issue, and that's the principal issue on appeal, and that is the trial court's error in awarding sole decision-making to the father, Golden Tullis, despite finding that he perpetrated domestic violence throughout the marriage, and that as a result of that domestic violence, a 191 limitation was warranted. Now,
so I have to tell you, I'm more interested in hearing from you with regard to the distribution of the RSUs.
Okay.
You indicate in your briefing that the distribution was incorrect.
Yes.
And the argument seems to be that it was incorrect because the trial court relied on the wrong vesting schedule.
Yes.
That vesting schedule was apparently Exhibit 49.
Yes. Let me be clear, though. That was not the trial court's intent. That's what happened.
How do you know?
Because the court said that in its oral decision and not only instructed the parties to use Exhibit 183, which was my client's vesting schedule and the one she testified to at trial.
The court specifically told the parties to use Exhibit 183?
I referred to the vesting schedule in that exhibit by date and by number.
Right. And didn't you have an opportunity then to argue to the trial court at the presentation of orders that, and didn't you argue that Golden's schedule was wrong?
What we argued at presentation when it became obvious that he had in fact reverted to exhibit, it was either 42 or 49, his vesting schedule, was that he had done that, which he had not complied with the court's oral decision, and he insisted that he had.
That the court chose to specifically adopt it in its written findings anyway.
Based on his insistence that he was acting consistent with the court's oral decision.
So your argument really is that the court somehow got snookered and adopted a vesting schedule it wasn't aware that it adopted?
That it adopted a distribution of assets that was not consistent with its intent. And I would refer the court to Report of Proceedings 1664-77.
Well, I've read the oral ruling, but the court doesn't incorporate anywhere in its written findings that it's adopting its oral ruling. So what does its oral ruling matter to us?
Well, I think its oral ruling matters when a party stands in front of the court and inaccurately states that the orders being presented to the court are consistent with the court's intent, and they in fact are not.
So was there a motion for reconsideration?
There was.
And that was denied?
It was.
Because the court, again, was confused about what it was adopting in terms of the distribution of the vesting?
Well, Your Honor, there's certainly no indication that the court intended to change its mind. I mean, a party literally stood before the court and said, I am applying short to the first post-dissolution tranche, and that was false.
Well, depending on which vesting schedule you look at, right?
Yes, but not...
So isn't it possible that the court said, I've decided since I've given my oral ruling that I'm going to adopt Exhibit 49 as the vesting schedule on which I'm going to apply short and distribute accordingly?
Except that the court never made that indication.
Does the court have to make that indication?
No, I suppose it doesn't, but you have no way of knowing whether the court was thinking that or whether was it, in fact, as you put it, snookered into doing something that it did not intend to do.
But as long as the distribution is consistent, so if you were to go through the court's findings and decree and see that the distribution is consistent with the short application to the vesting schedule in Exhibit number 49, is there error? Isn't it up to the court to determine how to weigh the evidence and who's more credible?
It is up to the court to pick the vesting schedule that it thinks is accurate. And the court indicated which one it was picking, and it never indicated otherwise.
Well, didn't it indicate that it was inclined to rely on Exhibit 74, which was the, spreadsheet dividing liability and assets that was offered by Golden? And wasn't Exhibit 49 the basis of that distribution in Exhibit 74?
It was if you go through the math and devise that, but the problem, again, is what you're effectively saying is that a party can stand in court and lie and say, here's an order that reflects your decision, and insist over and over and over again, despite my client saying that does not reflect your decision, that is not the asset sheet, the RSU.
I suppose only if the court's said this is my decision. Can you point me to the page in the transcript from the oral argument where the court says, I adopt Exhibit 183 as the vesting schedule, and to that I will apply the short analysis time rule?
I believe it's at Report of Proceedings 1633. I would have to check. And I do not recall whether the court specifically says 183, but the court lays out the vesting schedule by date and by RSU amount that is consistent with 183 and with my client's testimony.
If what you say is true, why would the court deny the motion for reconsideration?
I don't know. It was filed under a different cause number because there was a DVPO going as well. And that happened throughout this case, and we point that out in the reply brief, that pleadings were getting put into different files.
Did the court issue an order on the motion for reconsideration?
I do believe so, and I think that was under the wrong cause number
as well. The court saw it then.
Yes.
So are you arguing that there's not substantial evidence to support Exhibit 49?
No, I'm not. I'm arguing that that was not the court's intent to adopt Exhibit 49, and that a party stood in court and either by mistake or out of dishonesty, insisted that the orders being presented to the court were consistent with the court's oral ruling when they were in fact not. Now, it would be a different scenario if the court said, you know what, I changed my mind, but that is not what happened here. And if the court's inclined to reverse and remand because the trial court absolutely has to order sole decision-making to my client under this court's decision in Mansour and under the plain language of the statute, then at least give the court the opportunity to revisit this issue as well. And if the court says, you know what, I changed my mind, then so be it. But at this point, there is no indication that that's what the trial court did. And this court should reverse and remand the financial issues as well. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hang on a second.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Mesplay for the respondent, Golden Tullis. If you have difficulty hearing me through this mask, please let me know. Following an 8-day trial, the trial court entered detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law concerning the parties' parental roles and the division of assets and debts.
How do you reconcile RCW 2609-187? With the trial court's decision to grant sole decision-making authority to the person against whom the trial court imposed 191 restrictions?
Certainly, Your Honor. First of all, Chapter 2609 RCW says over and over again that the primary consideration when formulating a parenting plan is the best interests of the
child. I understand the best interest of the child standard. What I'm interested in is the specific language of 2609-187-2B, which says the court shall order sole decision-making to one parent when it finds that a limitation on the other parent's decision-making is mandated by 191. How can we interpret that to mean anything other than sole decision-making needs to be awarded to the other parent?
Well, that 187 has to be read in conjunction with 191. Mm-hmm. And 191 does not specify which parent should have sole decision making. It simply says that mutual decision making is prohibited. That statute.
But doesn't 187 then give you the answer to the if it can't be both, which one? Doesn't it tell you which one?
I would argue that it doesn't.
Well, what words would you rely on when it says that it has to give it to one parent when the limitation is on the other parent? There are only two players here, and others one of them, and that's the one with limitations. So what words would we write in a sentence to explain what the words mean here that gets to your result?
Well, I would argue that 187 simply states when mutual decision-making is prohibited and when sole decision-making can be considered. And if you look at
but
Section
C. But it doesn't say
C,
that. It says it to one parent when it finds the other parent. What do we do with the word other?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that that is simply a prohibition on mutual decision making, consistent with the other part B and.
Well, why would you even need B1 if that's all it was? 09191 says no mutual decision making if there's our limitations. I mean, we would have to say this statute's superfluous, then, wouldn't we?
I already know that you don't, because 187 is just a generic list of when mutual decision-making is prohibited and when sole decision-making is permissible. If you look at 187...
So what would the intent be behind a statute requiring sole decision-making to go to one parent when domestic violence findings are made against the other?
The intent of the prohibition on mutual decision-making is to prevent conflict between the two parties, between the two parents, because that conflict can be damaging to the children. So this is a conflict minimizing statute.
Would you think giving decision making to the parent who's found to be a domestic violence perpetrator accomplishes that goal or furthers that goal?
I believe it does. In the majority of situations, yes. It will not be in the best interest of the child to give sole decision-making to the person against whom 191 findings are found.
Well,
but that's
section,
not always
but section
the case.
N gives a discretion to the court to do things like choose not to modify residential time with somebody.
Correct.
Under such a finding, but it doesn't give such a specific exception with regard to sole decision making. And you seem to be arguing that, well, if it's the best interest of the kids, the court has the discretion to be able to make this change to what the plain language of the statute is. But that's not in the statute. And if they intended it for it to be there, wouldn't they have written it into the statute?
That's found in another statute. That's 2609003.
So your indication that you're arguing that the best interest of the child standard can override anything in the remainder of Chapter 29.
Yes.
Has any Washington court said that?
No Washington court has had the opportunity to consider it.
So no.
In Mansour, the only issue there was whether mutual decision making was permitted at all, because in that case they had...
Now, under the facts of this case, if we find the court couldn't give your client sole decision-making, is there any choice other than to give the other parent sole decision-making?
No, there is not. Because mutual decision-making is prohibited, there would be no other choice. That is correct, Your Honor.
So moving on, the court in its oral ruling refers to Exhibit 183, which is... which was Leslie's offered vesting schedule.
Yes.
A number of times, and seems to make some determinations based on that schedule.
Correct.
Yet in its written findings, the court adopts Exhibit 49, which I should point out to the parties was not designated as an exhibit, so I don't know what's in Exhibit 49 other than what the court describes in its findings. The court relies on Exhibit 49. Does the court have to explain why it relies on Exhibit 49 and how it came to that conclusion?
No, it does not.
Why not?
The court does not need to explain why it changes its mind in the findings of fact. And we can't speculate as to why the court decided to adopt one in its written findings and despite its comments in the oral ruling. There are multiple cases that say that the written findings control over the oral ruling, and you can only consult the oral ruling if there's some sort of ambiguity in the written orders that needs to be fleshed out. Otherwise, what is said in the oral ruling does not matter.
Was there ambiguity in the oral ruling as to which vesting schedule the court intended to apply the short rule?
No, Your Honor, and there is no ambiguity in the written findings. And that's where, if there had been ambiguity in the written findings, then we could look towards the court's oral ruling.
Should we be at all concerned that the court was unaware that the written findings were different than its oral ruling?
I don't think that the court was unaware. The court read the final order before it signed it. It clearly did because it made written modifications to the findings in fact and conclusions of law.
Was this particular argument about the application of Short argued at the presentation hearing?
There was no... The application of Short was never an issue. It was just which vesting schedule...
Maybe I asked a bad question. Was the appropriateness of the vesting schedule incorporated in the written findings discussed or argued in the presentation of either counsel?
Yes.
Was the court made aware that there was a disagreement between counsel about whether the findings used the correct vesting schedule?
Yes, it was.
So one couldn't argue that the judge didn't know that there was something in there different than Exhibit 183.
That is correct. And that is found where that is pointed out is RP 1675 and 1-1676. And as for the motion for reconsideration, I would note that it was not filed until 19 days after the final orders were entered. That's untimely. There is no way for it to have been timely. CR 6 specifically prohibits
any extension.
Doesn't that
actually kind of hurt you? If the court denied it because it was untimely, it doesn't mean it looked at the decision again.
I don't see how that hurts.
Well, if it was actually looking at the motion for reconsideration on the merits and decided to stick with the written findings, that would suggest that it was fully aware that Exhibit 49 was the basis for those findings rather than 183. Whereas if it just decided this is untimely, then maybe it didn't look at anything that it had done before and just said, oh, this is too late, I don't have to worry about it.
Well, we don't know what the court's decision was because there was no order entered on it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the court...
There was no order denying the motion for reconsideration?
There is no order on the motion for reconsideration at all that I could see on the...
Either in the DVPO file or the family law or dissolution file?
I do not know about the DVPO file. I wasn't aware until the reply briefing that that was even...
Well, because counsel suggests that there was some confusion about cause numbers and some orders got filed in one file rather than the other file.
Certainly. In the dissolution case, there is no order on the motion for reconsideration.
Thank you.
So, Judge Bowman, let me go first to your question about reconciling Section 187.2b with the trial court's decision. And the answer to that question is that you can't, because 187 is abundantly clear. And Judge Leach, as you put it, 187 involves two players, the one and the other. My client is the one because she was not the domestic violence perpetrator. And Golden Tullis is the other because he is the domestic violence perpetrator. So it is clear under the plain language of that statute, as well as in this court's decision in Mansour, that my client must be awarded sole decision making. And Judge Bowman, just for clarification on 2N, as you pointed out there correctly, 2N does not change limitations on decision making authority. It only allows the trial court to mitigate the harshness of limitations on residential time, but not decision making authority. So the trial court's invocation of Section 191.2N here has no bearing on decision-making authority. That is a clear error, and this court should reverse and remand. I'd like to give the court a couple of citations to the record on the RSU issue because it's become a major concern as to what exactly was going on at that presentation hearing and whether it was drawn to the trial court's attention that it was not using the vesting schedule that it said it was using. And Judge Bowman, to your question as to where the court said that it wanted to use Exhibit 183, that's at Report of Proceedings 1621 and 1633. Not only referring to the exhibit, but referring to the vesting dates and, more importantly, to the vesting numbers. Because what happens is that the first tranche is 68.
I know that the court referred to it. I know that the court actually read from it.
And lays out the schedule.
Lays it out.
Right.
I'm aware of that. But the court also refers to Exhibit 74, which is a bit in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And the court indicates in its oral ruling, actually maybe in the presentation ruling, that it would incorporate its oral argument, that it almost always incorporates its oral argument, and so it doesn't want to have to get very detailed in the written argument,
mm-hmm.
or in the written ruling, so it could incorporate its oral ruling, yet the court didn't incorporate the oral ruling. Can we infer something from that?
I suppose my answer to that, Your Honor, would be rather than make inferences and guesses about what the trial court is doing, is to reverse the case to the trial court for a decision consistent with this court's opinion, which is that sole decision-making must be vested in my client, and allow the trial court to decide whether it was changing its mind or whether it was intending to do exactly what it set out to do. And so for that, I would point the court to report of proceedings, and this is a comparison between 1621, 1633, and 1648, all places where the trial court indicates its intent with the RSUs. And then 1669 to 77, where Golden Tullis insists to the trial court that he is applying the short time rule to the first post-dissolution tranche, which is false.
Well, based on his vesting schedule.
He doesn't say that. He's talking about being consistent with the court's oral decision.
In my spreadsheet, I apply it to the first tranche. And that first tranche is consistent, at least by my calculations, with what the court indicates what was in Exhibit 49, which was Golden's vesting schedule. Am I wrong?
I don't disagree that he's saying I'm applying short to the first tranche, I'm applying the short time rule to the first tranche. The question is, what is that first tranche? And the court made a decision about that, and there is no indication it intended to change its mind. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes this matter. We'll take a short recess.